Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another in my ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My guest today is not only an author, but also the founder of the History Publishing Company. His name is Don Bracken. Don, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Simon. It's a pleasure to be here. It's been quite some time since we last chatted.
Yeah, it certainly has been a while. I see that History Publishing Company has expanded into some new imprints. But before we talk books, how about telling our audience a little about yourself? Who is Don Bracken?
Well, that's a long look I'm taking because I'm 79 years of age and there's a lot of history in my life. I'm a person who grew up in the Bronx, New York, gravitated toward the suburbs of Rockland County and Sneeden's Landing in Palisades. And I was an entrepreneur, had some good businesses, and at the age of 60 or so, I decided to retire, sold out my business, and traveled the world. I went to Timbuktu one day, and I was sitting on a sand dune, and I said, what will I do with the rest of my life? And I decided that I would go into publishing. When I was in college early on, I had thought about doing that, but I met my wife while I was in the Army, and that changed things, and I ended up in the business world, other than publishing. So at that stage, sitting on that sand dune in Timbuktu, or just north of it, I should say, I decided to change my life and add some meaning to it. So at the age of 72, I decided to do that. And since I had no books to go with, I decided that I would write the first two. One for my HPC imprint, which is really where my heart was, and the other for today's books in the event that the world didn't find history that interesting. They certainly would, those people turning 50. So I wrote a book on turning 50 and starting a new career. But that didn't do as well as I would have liked, but the other did. The Words of War was the history book, and that was a comparative analysis of the writings of the New York Times and the Charleston Mercury for 14 battles of the American Civil War. It was designed that the reportage that we read is written by human beings with their own political perspectives and their own emotional involvement. So we have to be careful about what we hear in the media. It's all good stuff, but it has to be filtered for their human side. And that way we'll be able to make a better analysis of what's going on in the world.
I have read Words of War, and I love it. It's a truly unique book.
It won an award, actually. The Forward magazine had it up there as History Book of the Year, alongside Macmillan and Yale University Press. So that gave me an awful lot of good feeling, shall we say, about what I was doing. So that was my encouragement to go forward, and I did. I had some Civil War background, though. Previously, I had computer plotted the American Civil War, the 384 major battles, and breaking them down by the five theaters of operation. The National Park Service liked them, and they featured them at a number of their outlets, their parks. So that was another thing we did as well. And it just was very gratifying to know that there was some appreciation for the work that was done here.
And by the way, a copy of Words of War resides in our local high school library, as does a set of History Scope.
Indeed, that's the 384 major battles that I just referred to. It's a it's an analysis of the intensity of the American Civil War. There was over 10,000 conflicts, but there was over 384 major battles. Think about that. 384 major battles over 4 years. That's almost one or two a week.
Right.
For 4 years.
Yeah. It's almost as bad as what's happening in the Middle East.
Yes. Right on. Right on. There's no end to it. Same anyway. But that was something, that was a launching pad, you might say, for History Publishing Company.
Right. I think it's fair to say that the world of books is not for the faint at heart. It's interesting. I hear gripes from authors about, you know, unscrupulous publishers, and I hear gripes from publishers about authors with unrealistic expectations. Oh, and I hear gripes from all sides about distribution channels, particularly Amazon. You're in the unique position of being able or being stuck, you know, wearing all three hats. You know, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are many. I guess you might have guessed. Let's take the authors first. I think most authors come into the publishing aspect with visions of grandeur, and they think they'll make a lot of money. Well, in reality, they won't. There's not a lot of money in publishing. It's the reason why there's not a lot of money in publishing is because there's roughly 2 million published each year. The competition is very fierce, and the reading public can only consume so many. So unless you get a big breakaway bestseller, most books don't do as well as the first-time author would like them to think it is. So that's the reality of it. But there's a big upside to writing a book. It's not the money so much, but it's the life-changing factor. If a person writes a book that has some meaning, it can change their life because it will get attention if it's marketed properly. And that attention can lead to an awful lot of doors that will open. And I've had a lot of authors benefit by it that way. They didn't make a lot of money on the books. Some did, but most of them don't make a lot of money. But they do have wonderful life-changing experiences. So that's one thing on the author side. There's two authors out there. There's 2 million books published each year. The visibility for your book is brutal. You have to get out there and really push hard for it to make itself known. As far as the other aspect goes about the unscrupulous publishers, well, of course, everybody thinks we are because they see the big numbers going out, but they don't see the big numbers coming back. There's a thing called returns, which is a cancerous thing in the industry, that's my opinion. There's a thing in our industry, unlike most industries, you sell your product to a retailer, and he will sell so many, and when he doesn't sell, he'll return those. Now, I don't know of any industry where that happens, but it happens in the book publishing industry. So there's an illusion created by the books that are sold. Well, they're not really sold when we send them out, where they're really placed on consignment in a sense. And what's not sold is returned to us, and there's a deduction made. And that is where it takes well over 4 months, 5 months for this thing to get sorted out. So that's the problem we have. Most contracts call for a 6-month royalty statement. And it's great to do that on time, and sometimes it's a little difficult because you want to assess the returns to make the thing work properly. So that's part of the problem that is the cause for publishers being looked at with jaundiced eyes. So keep that in mind to you publishers out there, to you authors out there, that's the part of the problem that we have to deal with is those returns that often come back, and they come back always at the worst time. But anyway, that's that end of it. And what's the other one?
Oh, the distribution channels, Amazon.
Okay. Amazon is the big gorilla today, and they're all over the world. I mean, these folks are incredible. Jeff Bezos has done a remarkable job of changing the way we live, much more than most people have. And I think that the book that he has, the books that he has out there.
I mean, he has a couple of million in his website.
So I think you have to realize that he's the big guy. But as far as the bookstores, Barnes & Noble is the main one. That's the big one. And they're cutting down their stores, and that's a matter of concern. Borders went out of business, as you may have heard. And also Books A Million is down there in the South. They're trying to get to be bigger. They're number two. But Barnes & Noble is the king of bookstores. There's no doubt about that. Across the country, there's also some significant independent publishers like Books and Greetings in Northern New Jersey, Book Passage in the Bay Area in San Francisco, and a number of others around the country. And I think those guys are doing a pretty good job too. But it's not an easy thing. There's only so many books they can take in, and the lines of distribution can't get overly cluttered because they just won't work that way. And the bookstores will take in the books if they know that they're going to be promoted by the publisher and the author. The author has to play. He's got a big hand in today's marketplace. If he doesn't get involved in out there in the marketplace, his book's not going to happen. It's just not going to work. And he'll have a tough time getting republished.
One of the things I have noticed over the years, is the term "if you build it, they will come." Doesn't work, right?
No.
An author has to be active in marketing his or her own book.
No doubt about it. That's the key to a successful book. We have a book out now called Unabomber, How the FBI Broke Its Own Rules to Capture the Terrorist Ted Kaczynski. It's authored by the three of the FBI agents who led the chase that finally captured Kaczynski. And they're going up and down the Barnes & Noble stores on the California coast. They've opened up 20 of them for book signing affairs. And the word gets out to all the other Barnes & Noble stores, and they want them. So this is what happens. When you get out there and you start working hard to make yourself known, it catches on because not too many do it. So a key piece of advice to the new author, when you get a publisher and you're going to get the book out there, go into the bookstores and keep in touch with the publisher too. Let him know what's going on. He'll help you. But go in and get all of these signings and try and do it on Barnes & Noble because it'll become known. It's a whole network, so they'll get to know the ones who are really working and they'll back you up with stock. So I would suggest you try that. And it's worked for us, and I think it can work for anyone who diligently approaches the work effort in the marketplace.
You publish three imprints. You have History Publishing Company, Today's Books, and Chronology Books. Tell us a little about the brands.
Well, History Publishing, of course, almost speaks for itself. This is the book about how history was created by the people who did that. I mentioned before, our books started off with The Words of War, comparing the reportage of the New York Times and the Charleston Mercury for the same 14 battles. That was an interesting book. The concept hadn't been done before, which is why it got so much attention, and that worked well for us. But then a number of books came along. Jim Heafy came up with a book for me called Ledger Domain, which had to do with the United States Air Force in the Cold War and the Harry Truman administration. We had a secret storage of atomic bombs on a French air base that the French did not know about. This was in Morocco, and it was a NATO base, really, but it was on French soil because Morocco was a colony then. And then it turned out that Morocco was in a difficult stage of political unrest, and it looked like the communists might take over. So Truman was concerned about that falling into the hands of the communists. So he sent an undercover team over there to help the nationalists
expel the French from their own colony before the communists did. So, but the thing was that we had a secret storage of atomic bombs there. The French never knew about it. And the reason we did is because it was the only air base long enough to take a B-36 in our Strategic Air Command, which would be used in a retaliatory raid on the Soviet Union if they decided to go to war with us. So it's critically important that we have that that in friendly hands, that air base. So it was a wonderful story. It was almost like Casablanca. I love that book. To this day, I read it once in a while just for the sheer reading pleasure of it. It's one of those few books that comes along that it makes an impression. At least it did on me, and naturally I like it because it was one of my first books. But more than that, I like it because it's a wonderful read, and I can never talk enough about it. Ledger de Maine.
Right. In fact, I have a story for you. I'm not sure I've ever shared this with you. I do keep in touch with James Heafy.
Mm-hmm.
Several years ago, a postcard arrived in my mailbox, and it was from somewhere. Very foreign. I'm not sure it was Morocco. I think he might have been in Crete or somewhere like that. It was just a picture of a beach and a blue ocean. And the message on the back read, "Wish you were here, signed Jim."
And you had to scratch your head a few times to figure out where that came from.
No, I didn't. I assumed it was Mr. Heafy.
Oh, okay. he had quite a remarkable career. He also did another book for us on our Today's Books imprint called How to Survive in an Organization, which won the Ben Franken Award. It's a business book, but it's how to survive in an organization, and it's based upon common sense and some fascinating insight into the power structure in companies. Jim did a lot of corporate design too in his later years, so he spoke from the inside and knows exactly what goes in and what makes an organization run, and that's where the book came from. It was a wonderful book. I love that book. It makes so much common sense, and it was, I'm glad to say it was an award winner.
Yeah, and he's a character. Okay, you mentioned Terry Turchie.
Hmm.
He definitely is one of my favorite authors. I think his first book was Hunting the American Terrorist or something along those lines.
It was that. He wrote it with Dr. Kathleen Puckett. They were both in the FBI. She a psychologist, a clinical psychologist, as well as an agent, and he was a counterintelligence and counterterrorism specialist. Both there, one of the very few who had both wore both hats. And they wrote a book on the psychological aspects of terrorism in the United States, and they clinically profiled 10 of the more prominent American terrorists, and Ted Kaczynski being one of them, and then the fellow who destroyed Oklahoma City, I can't think of his name now, but boy, how fleeting is fame, huh? Or infamy, and the 10 terrorists that had made their mark on American soil. So they did that book, and that was the first FBI book we did. We've done five now. No, I think we've done six FBI books. The sixth is coming out next week, next month, actually. It's called The Street Agent by Wayne Manis, who had a remarkable career. Terry knows him well. He took on the Ku Klux Klan, the Aryan Nation, and the Mafia, and today he walks around very softly and carries a .357 Magnum in his retirement. And he's a wonderful writer. He said that if he lived in another time, he would have been a lawman in the Old West. But he's that kind of person. He's been likened to Rooster Cogburn.
I know there's a story behind hunting the American terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
Would you care to tell me the story?
That it comes from the psychological perspective on capturing terrorists. They used Kaczynski for some of it, and they used a few. They clinically profiled several others. The whole idea was to show that they all have a psychological makeup can be used against them. It can be used to track them down. FBI is an amazing place. They have files that are just so remarkably complete on people that they can pull out different components of a file and put them together and come up with a profile of a suspected terrorism and narrow down his area of criminal activity. So the FBI is a terrific laboratory for research. And in these books that we have, and Hunting the American Terrorist is very typical of that. It gives a good illustration of that. And I think that was the one book that that won two awards. I mean, we won a lot of awards. I mean, this is what keeps us going here, all these awards. Terry's book won two awards there, one for Forward Magazine and one for independent publishers. So I think that that book is an exceptional book, and it was the one book that the FBI referred to for terrorism in its 100th annual book on the history of the FBI, published by the FBI. So the one book they used on terrorism as a reference was that one. That speaks for itself.
Oh, okay. Now, what I was actually trying to get at was the original manuscript. I seem to recall you saying something along the lines of it read like an FBI report.
Yeah, that's what it was, actually. Terry never wrote a book before. That's all he ever wrote were FBI memos. You know, so when I got the manuscript in, I thought I was reading an FBI file, you know. I had to call him up and tell him, I think we have a different approach needed here. So, and then he turned out to be a good writer. He really very adjustable. And Kathy, the co-author on that, lent a great hand to it also. She's a psychologist by training, and together they really scratched their heads and got the message and reworked the entire thing to good effect, I would say. Yeah, but that's true. You have a good memory. I remember you were laughing about that when I first told you years ago. It was funny.
Oh, I just laughed and laughed and laughed. Oh.
You've got a good memory, by the way. I got to keep that in mind. Whatever I say obviously goes into your think tank there, and it never goes away.
Right. I have a question for you. Obviously, History Publishing Company is a, and I mean this in a derogatory sense, you know, a niche area. And how on earth do you find the great authors that you publish?
Well, believe it or not, I don't look for them. They come to us. We're listed in Publishers Marketplace, which is a book for authors. And there's a profile of us. So anyone that comes in with a book that remotely is a history book, they naturally pull up history, and then up we come, History Publishing Company. So we've had best-selling authors come that way. Peter Meltzer came to us that way, and
Michael S. Malone, who was a best-selling author out of Silicon Valley, came up that way. And we've got a few others. We've got some best-selling authors here because of the name of our company, History Publishing Company. And then on top of that, we've been very careful to cultivate books that we think are award winners. You know, when you start out, you have to build credibility. And the only way you can do that is to get acknowledged. And the only way you can get acknowledged, because you're dealing with Simon & Schuster and Random House and all those people who've got terrific years of experience and the connections in the media, we had none of that. So the only way we could build credibility was to win awards for our books, so we pushed for that. And then every opportunity we had, we submitted books for consideration for awards, and more often than not, the ones that we submitted got recognized. And so we use that as our building credibility for the quality of our work. And then when they see the fact that when people looking, you know, acknowledged authors say that we're the real deal, I mean, we have good books, then they feel confident that we can do a good job for them. And it's worked out pretty well for the most part.
Trick question. Approximately, how many books do you have in print right now?
I think we're just up close to 100 now. We have close to 50 hardcover, 50 e-books, and we got all those history scope things too. We got over 100 publications right now.
Wow, you mentioned e-books, that was a subject I wanted to ask you about. Today's readers don't seem to like toting around large hardbacks, even though I do. I love the the tactile adventure of paper and ink. Is paper going away? Are we headed for the e-book world?
Well, I think eventually we probably will see more of that than not. There'll always be some sort of paper book that we can look at, and I don't know how far down the road that will be, but there will be some that will be a little more than absolute minimal to meet the requirement of the Library of Congress. But I think as far as a commercial item, it's the marketplace will govern all of that, and price is a big factor in e-book versus the hardcover, for example. You get an e-book, it's $3 or $4, and a hardcover book is $28, so there's a big difference in the marketplace there. I think a big factor to libraries, their adjustment to providing e-books is a significant factor too. And I think the library has always been a huge market for books. A lot of us depend upon getting good acceptance by the libraries. But when that acceptance is e-book, it's a whole different thing. It's an economic factor, too, you have to consider, because the idea of publishing an e-book is absolutely it's minimal. You don't have to do any runoffs. All you do is lay out a book and design a cover, and you're in business. That's all, and then get it converted. That's really can be very inexpensive when you have to run off a pile of books and get them out there and then suffer the returns that go with it and then everything else that goes with those problems, warehousing concerns. Everybody likes e-books better for a good reason. But that's economics. That's business.
I don't like them. I like to sit on my front porch with a real book.
Well, you and me too. I could never get used to having a mechanical device in my hand. I'll take the feel of cloth and paper. I like hardcover. I have a library. I don't own a Kindle, and I don't own anything like that. All my books are hardcover, and I love them that way. They just it's a comfort zone for me too. I share that with you. I can tell by what you said that you probably feel the same way I do.
Oh, indeed. Okay. I think we should do some shameless commercialization. What is your website, And where can people buy copies of your wonderful books?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. I was thinking my website is historypublishingco.com. And there they can see our books, and we have several pages there they can go through and get a whole idea of who we are.
I don't know how to phrase this question. I know Terry, and I know James, but what other delicacies do you have in your gourmet library?
Oh, well, the books that we have for sale that we can get at historypublishingco.com or on Amazon or at Barnes & Noble are many. We have, well, Breaking Iraq was another book. We had Terry co-authored that with Colonel Ted Spain. Ted Spain was a colonel in the 18th Military Police Brigade in the invasion of Iraq, and he was the in charge of the MPs in Baghdad for a year after the invasion. And he wrote a book, it's called Breaking Iraq, the 10 Decisions That Broke Iraq, and that's what we're seeing today, the 10 decisions that set up the difficulties that we're experiencing over there, and that Iraq certainly is. So that's a book that got a lot of attention. It really did. It came out on the 10th anniversary of the invasion, so it was very timely. That's a book that Ted Spain was the co-author along with Terry Turchie on that one. The we have, so much stuff here. That one is called So You Think You Know the Presidents by Peter Meltzer. Here's a book of fascinating facts about every president, not just the normal things about when he went into office and so forth, but these are the human side of each president, things to know about the president that you didn't think you knew. And Peter Meltzer is the author also of The Thinker's Thesaurus. You may have heard of that one. Norton did that one. And also he did So You Think You Know Baseball. He did that one. I think Norton had that one too, and we got the president's book. So that's an interesting book that I would suggest. We also have one. It's called the Words of War. That was mine, of course. But We Were Darn Good. It's about the teachers in the Middle West who were teaching people in the log cabins and so forth. These were the folks who would go out on horseback around to teach the children who had to be taught in a nation that was growing up. That was an important book, an important factor at the time, and it's a book that was well-placed. And then we have To Help Me God, written by Jim Costanzo. This is about all the Bibles that made it to the inauguration and how they got there. It's a fascinating story of that. And Jim went into all of the background. He sets the stage, too, for each inauguration. And also over the course of time, not only does he tell you about the Bible, but he shows you how the culture has changed in the United States, going from each inauguration to the next up to the present one. Fascinating book. I thought that was a great one. And another one that came out that was a very important book, got a lot of play, was written by James Cotton, who's a judge down in Tennessee. And he he lives in Oneida, Tennessee, and he was a General Sessions judge, and he wrote a book called on the Gettysburg Address. And what it was it's called The Greatest Speech Ever, by the way. The title's The Greatest Speech Ever. And it's about how Lincoln found the words to use, and how he found those concepts that he used. And he goes into Lincoln's life, and he focuses on those parts of his life that gave birth to the concepts of the Gettysburg Address. Great book, a terrific book. I think it's something that should be in every school, and I think that it's a book that I will talk about for a long time. And James Baker, the senator who just died, wrote the foreword.
So wow.
Anyway, that's a book that came out on the anniversary date of the Gettysburg Address in November.
What advice would you offer to a would-be author? I mean, it's one thing sitting down at your typewriter. Oh, we don't use those anymore. But, you know, it's an entirely a different deal publishing a book.
I would say that before you even write the first word, think of who you're writing it for. Carve out the market that you're aiming for. You have to do that. If you don't do that, you probably won't get published. That's the reality of it. You have to find out who you're writing the book for and aim it at that particular section of the readership. It's a niche. You can't appeal to everybody. A lot of writers who don't know the business will say, well, everybody will like it. Well, that's not quite the case. Not everybody's going to like it. But the book will appeal to a certain element in the in the population. And that's who you write the book for, if you want to be successful. If you don't care about success, then do whatever you want to do. But if you want to be successful, narrow down that niche in the population you're writing it for, because that's what publishers look for. If you don't do that, the publishers aren't going to be interested, by the way. So that's just a little inside information.
I will take that as gospel. and definitely a truism.
Yeah, it's so true, so true.
And some publishers can be somewhat secret about their projects. I have an example, but I won't use it, other than to say that Simon and Schuster were the guilty party. Yeah, I don't see that in you. So, what do you have cooking in the oven right now? What's coming up soon, or not soon?
Well, we have what we have in January 1. It's called Wiki Wars, written by John Sutherland, who's down in the Department of Defense and who was a special operations Army officer. He was a pathfinder and an airborne guy, and you know all of those remarkable units that he was in. He wrote a book called Wiki Wars on the changing nature of warfare and how it's changing. For example, when we used to go to war, we went to war against another country, like in the old days, Germany or Japan or whoever it was. We went to war against a country. Today it's not happening. We're not going to war with countries. We're going to war with groups. Hamas is a group, Al-Qaeda. This is what we're dealing with. It's a changing nature of warfare. And our military is making adjustments to change to that. And that's what the book is about. It's going to be the nature the nature of warfare as it's coming to be. And it's going to be an important book that's coming out in January.
You know, I watch the news every day, and I see a distinct move away from a horrible term, boots on the ground. I see drones, and obviously the cyber side of life, you know. Is that where we're heading? You know, the next war won't be with guns. It will be with computers.
It has to be, because it's the only way that nations can fight established countries. They don't have the tanks or the planes or the submarines that we have. So they have to use what they have, and what they have is the cyber warfare will be a big element of it. All you need is a couple of sharp brains who know how to work computers, and then how to develop computers into high-level operations. That's a big part of what the war is going to be like in the future. Also, too, the nature of warfare has changed as we know it. Hot warfare, like we had in World War II or Korea or Vietnam, that's changing, too, because if you looked in Iraq and Afghanistan, most of the soldiers over there and the Marines over there were wounded, not by bullets, but by roadside bombs. And the IED was invented as a device because they didn't have the economics to do anymore, but they didn't realize. Unfortunately, they came up with an extra advantage because most of the wounds that occurred they didn't kill them. They wounded people, and they blew off their limbs and their genitalia and their all sorts of things and made them alive. But so you had to care for them. So the cost factor of going to war is enormous now because when you take someone who's wounded like that, the limbs blown off, he goes in the hospital, and it costs the government about $5 million to take care of him in the first year. And it's going to cost the government $1 million a year for the rest of that person's life. So you multiply that by all the soldiers that we have and all the Marines who have been beat up and wounded like that, who have the rest of their lives incapacitated, they have to be cared for. It's a financial burden. That's an aspect that was never written into the war when we went to war with Iraq and Afghanistan, but it's what's happened. Now, the reason it's happened is because the terrorists over there had no other recourse but to do things like that because we had all the armored warfare and the trucks and so forth, so they wanted to stop that. They didn't realize that the big benefit to them was the changing nature of wounds. It's a lot less expensive economically if a soldier gets killed than it is if he's wounded like that. So the fact that he's wounded and has to be cared for is a plus factor for the enemy.
Yeah, ouch.
The nature of war is driven by economics. It's all economics. That's economic on the part of the terrorist, but also the cyber warfare, which is larger, much larger scale. I mean, that's really where it's going to be. China is already a big deal in that. So those folks don't need to go to war with us. They don't have to plan on doing that. Anything that they do plan is for a stalemate kind of thing. It's a chess game. The reality is going to be in cyberspace. That's my guess. And for out in the boonies, it's going to be the nature of what we're seeing now. And it's not going to be against countries, but against groups. When you go back into history, you go back into the Roman Empire in the 400 AD, they weren't at war with countries. They were at war with the Vandals, the Picts, the Goths, the Visigoths, all those guys. They were the historical version of Al-Qaeda and all these other guys, ISIS and all these other folks. So that's what we have to deal with.
Our time is almost up, but I want to ask you if you have any final thoughts you would like to share with our listeners.
Well, I would say keep buying History Publishing Company books, that they will keep you well acquainted with what happened in the past, and we will also keep you acquainted as to what is about to happen in the future that will make history tomorrow.
All right. I like that. There's a third imprint that you have. We have talked about HPC and a little bit about today's books. What about chronology books? What's the story there?
That's about. I like this. This is a great imprint. It's about history that was made, but not by people who were the central figures, but by people who are either witnesses of it or were minor participants in it. And so it's a first-hand view of history. One of them that I liked was Custer Survivor, written by John Custer, an historian of the West. And he came up with the proof positive, and I think it's proof positive, of the fact that one man did escape Custer's little Bighorn disaster. And apparently one sergeant did get away, Sergeant Finkel in C Company. He got away because he got wounded, and his horse panicked. His horse got wounded. The horse panicked and bolted and carried him away. And Rain in the Face, who was a Sioux chief, saw him and said and testified to that. And John Custer came up with a terrific book on that subject. So that was one book. It got a lot. It got starred, reviewed by Library Journal and Publishers Weekly. And there's a great book. History Channel also did a thing on it. They made an hour show on it. So that book, it put a lot of people into the thought process that maybe a guy did escape. He probably did. Well, we proved he did, and it's pretty hard for people to accept that a myth is no longer a myth, but there's some reality in there. That was one book that I liked. That's a chronology book. Another book is forthcoming. It's coming out now. It's called The Street Agent, and that's by Wayne Manis, who was an FBI agent who refused or didn't really take the promotion he wanted to go up into, but wanted to stay in the street. He's a former Marine officer who liked the confrontational aspect of law and order, and he was a man who took on the Mafia, the Ku Klux Klan, the Aryan Nation, and all those left-wing liberals back in the early days of all of that miserable. Before, I shouldn't have put it that way. It's not the liberals, but the left-wing extremists, that's the word I wanted, who back in Chicago, he was caught up in the middle of that Chicago eruption that took place during the Democratic administration. Anyway, he goes into you get the inside and all this. It's fascinating stuff. And that's one book we have coming out September 16th. And we have a few others, too. How much time do I have?
Oh, you can have as much time as you want. I always enjoy talking to you.
Well, I enjoy talking about my books to you, Simon. You listen well. You ask great questions. And I'll tell you some books we had. The Right Frequency was a book that we saw that came out. It's about, it's about how right-wing radio has an influence on conservative politics in this country. That was kind of interesting. I didn't know much about it because I don't get a chance to listen to radio, but it was an interesting book by a guy who was a White House correspondent down there. So he had a pretty objective look on it. It was very very interesting. And then, a book that I find, and we talked about Terry Turchy before, a book that I find that was so ahead of its time was a book called Homeland Insecurity. This was how political power is a corrupting factor on the people in Washington. And it was just a terrific book. It was so timely, ahead of its time. It came out in 2008. It could be about today. It won a lot of awards. It won 3 awards, too. But the media didn't give it any play because it took on both sides of the political spectrum. And you can't take on both sides of the political spectrum and get any one of the media to endorse you or to listen to you, because you may be affecting some of their interests. So I understood that, and that's what happened. But it was a terrific book.
I loved Homeland Insecurity, by the way.
Well, someone as bright as you would have to, you'd have to. Yeah, it's a great book. I love that book. But I'll tell you another book that I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to finish up with, you're entirely right. I hadn't realized that Homeland Insecurity came out in 2008. I mean, you could publish it today.
I could, yeah.
You're right. Nothing has changed.
I know, isn't it? It's amazing. It truly is. Here's a book. We're going into fall now. I love this book. It's called Christmas 1945. It was the first Christmas after World War II, and it's how the nation changed, how the American spirit and the role of Christmas is examined. And we back in those days, you didn't have three-day weekends unless it happened that a major holiday happened on a Friday or a Monday. You just never had three-day weekends. The first one that came by that I know of or read about was by President Truman after World War II. He gave everybody in Washington 2 days off, Monday and Tuesday. Monday would have been a holiday anyway because Christmas is on Sunday. So he gave people Tuesday off too so they could travel and go home and all that. So it was a big deal. It was the biggest traffic jam in the history of the United States that weekend. And it was a wonderful book, and it became a bestseller in Barnes & Noble. That's Christmas 1945. Anyway.
Obviously, I have to do a lot of reading.
Well, do Christmas shopping too, and when it comes time Christmas, you can go to Barnes and Noble. I don't know if Barnes and Noble has it, but B&N, their website has it, and so does Amazon. And you can, it always does well on Amazon. It goes right up there. It's always hammering. It's always nose to nose with another book that makes its appearance every year too, like this one. I'm trying to think of the author now. He's such a prominent guy. He wrote the Truman biography. Oh boy. Okay. Anyway, I shouldn't bring it up. But anyway, he wrote a Christmas book that always seems to come up and goes nose to nose with Christmas 1945. It's great to watch books like that take place. I like Christmas. Christmas is it's a fun time.
Right. Now, you live in New York, I believe.
Yep. I do. Palisades, New York, which is on the Hudson River, just 9 miles north of the George Washington Bridge.
Well, New York always grabs me as being too busy. Yeah, how on earth do you survive in that environment?
Well, I'm native-born. I was born in Manhattan, and I've been growing up conditioned to the pace of the city. And, that's the way of life. You know, we all get conditioned early on to be what we become. You're born into a political party, a religion, and an environment. And I think that's what happens. And the environment I was born in was New York City. I was born in Manhattan. I grew up in Manhattan. I was educated in Manhattan, and I've chose to live in the metropolitan area. Now we are in the metropolitan area, but it's, even though we're countrified, but it's still, I like to think of myself as the New York metropolitan area.
You're countrified. I love that term.
Well, we have trees here.
Okay, I think it's probably time to wrap this interview up. Don, I really want to thank you for taking time out of your countrified day to chat with me. It has been great fun, and I do hope we can do this again soon.
I enjoyed it, Simon. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I appreciate it very much, and I hope we do too. It's great. I'll have a lot more books to talk about.
You bet. I'm going to put my thinking cap on. Until next time, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy, healthy, and safe week, and we'll be back again soon. Till next time, goodbye.
Mm-hmm.